Hi Philip, how are you doing?
Hi Adam, I'm doing fine. How are you?
Yeah, perfect. Already coded some Java. So, even, deleted some emails. So it's perfect.
No better way to start the day with perfect, some light Java.
Perfect morning. So, of course, you know the question. What's your first computer? Or what was your first computer?
Yes, I know the question. So the first computer I've ever used was actually not my own, but my parents' computer, which was, like a regular desktop computer. Mm-hmm. It already had an Intel Pentium CPU. Mm-hmm. I don't remember how much RAM it had, but it was on a 32-bit system, Windows XP. So probably less than 4 gigabytes. It was nothing too bad, already quite modern. Yeah, so this was the first computer I've ever used.
And I'm disappointed. I thought, Graviton. Okay, cool. What you did with the computer, with the XP?
I was playing some little games that it could run, mm-hmm. but unfortunately it didn't have, like a dedicated graphics chip. So it was quite limited.
But wait, 4 gigs is really... I started with Windows. My first Windows computer was Windows 95. Mm-hmm. And now the question is how much RAM. I think it is where it was 16 megs, right? I think, yeah. Okay, it can be 4 gigs, My first computer had, I think, 8 megs of RAM, not gigs, megabytes, So this is like a 4 gigs is a little, 4 gigs is already fine.
I think it was actually less than 4 gigs, maybe.
But 4 gigs is already fine. So 4 gigs is already a plenty. So I'll confuse now gigabytes and megabytes. So, okay. Little games. What was your favorite?
So my favorite was, it's like a car rally game. I think it's called Dirt. Probably it still exists today in some newer versions. You could drive like rally cars in the desert. It was quite fun. And it also had like a multiplayer version. So two people could play at the same computer in one screen.
Okay. Split screen, right?
Split screen, yes. The good old split screen times before the online multiplayer games became too popular.
Mm-hmm. This fascinated me at the beginning also, the multiplayer games. And and now it's normal. And how you transitioned from gaming to scripting or deleting drives or doing something different, damaging computers or whatever? Yeah,
this came up a bit later when I had my first own computer, which was a laptop, but it had a dedicated graphics chip, AMD Radeon, and I started playing Minecraft. So good Java example, of course. And the whole scripting stuff started when I wanted, to run my own server, because you had like these Minecraft multiplayer servers where you could play with your friends. Mm-hmm. And I thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool to host my own server? Mm-hmm. So I started looking a bit into how can I run my own server? How can I make it available to other people so I can play with my friends? At the time, my internet connection was very bad. It was less than 1 megabit per second. So running a Minecraft server was not really feasible. So I started looking into, these virtual private cloud servers where you can rent some virtual machines at different providers.
ISDN. Was it a German ISDN?
It was. Yeah. It was ISDN and then later ADSL. Mm-hmm. So it was quite slow. So
I also started with ISDN for a long time, and I had actually bundled two connections, I think, on my server. So there were 128K, right?
Yeah.
Or a kilobit or something like this. Okay, yes. This was... And DSL was already a dream. Exactly.
Yeah, so...
This is one of the reasons why I never had pictures on my blog. Because it was served for, and I could serve text perfectly, but one picture will destroy everything. So I never had pictures on my blog.
So your whole home connection went down if you served pictures from your blog.
Or even if the article became popular, it was a problematic experience back then. But exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so I started renting some tiny virtual private servers.
But wait, but Minecraft is just it. What happens behind the scenes? Is there a lot of traffic? Is there lots of demand on Minecraft?
You mean in terms of players joining the servers, or
yeah, if you have one server, my understanding is it's just, you know, the coordinates are actually the assets also exchanged, or just the coordinates? Do you know that? You know, how much traffic is expected per player in Minecraft for a Minecraft server?
I don't know about the traffic, but I remember the main limitation was memory, actually. As soon as people started joining the server and the world, the Minecraft world expanded and they started building things, my personal computer crashed sometimes because the memory or the server crashed, and then was a memory out of memory exception. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Out of memory exception error. And then you migrated to VPC.
Then I migrated to virtual private servers, yes.
VPS, yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I don't remember the first name of the provider where I rented a server. But I remember SSHing Hetzner. Into this. I think, Hetzner was my second provider. Mm-hmm. The one before, I don't remember. I had servers at Hetzner and at OVH.
How old were you back then?
How old was I? 13 years, maybe.
This is crazy. So this was that's crazy, actually.
Yeah. I started quite early. I still remember one time I SSH'd into the server and I expected some user interface to pop up, but it was just a Linux Debian server with a terminal, and I didn't even know how to go into a directory using CD. Mm-hmm. So I learned all of this stuff following internet tutorials, Stack Overflow, and some blog posts where people explained how to set up a Minecraft server. So this was quite fun, getting this up and running without actually knowing what I'm doing.
Yeah, but if it ran, it was a good experience, right? So, okay, no, yeah.
It was quite good. It crashed a few times.
For you. You achieved something. This was like, you know, secret powers. Okay, now I can run server somewhere, right? It's a good feeling.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a really good feeling the first time I could join the server. And it actually worked when I connected with the IP address. So, yeah, it was quite good to see the things that you are scripting on this little terminal actually start to work and other people can use it.
Mm-hmm. What happened then? You started to extend Minecraft, or how you learned programming, scripting, or whatever?
Yeah, so this was just playing around a little bit with Linux and some smaller bash scripts for automating things. For example, I still remember one thing I did was to set up a firewall for the server using IP tables. Mm-hmm. So whenever the server rebooted, I set up a small script that should run when the server boots to set up the IP table rules for the
which
firewall,
is already harder, I would say.
Which was quite a challenge for me at the time, yes.
It's not that hard, but if you do something wrong, you cannot connect anymore. So this is like, it takes a long time to do it correctly.
I was just about to say.
Yeah.
At some point, I locked myself out because I blocked the SSH port. And I remember calling the provider on the support on the phone line. And they could reset the server from backup. That was managed backups. So they did it for me, and I was quite happy that I didn't lose all my data because I was locked out. So this was an interesting experience.
Mm-hmm. A good experience, I would say, because I had similar experience later with Docker, because I had also had to set up, you know, the IP tables later. And also locked out myself several times. But this is how it is, right?
Yeah.
And what then? So what you did with the server? Or what was your transition to write as this? The first script was the IP table script.
Yes, this was the first script.
In shell or Z shell?
In Bash shell. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Z shell is later.
So I think it wasn't available yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. the real programming, I'd say, was in the HTML, or not programming.
Nice, okay.
Mm-hmm. Starting some little websites with HTML and CSS. Mm-hmm. And I found it quite satisfying to style the website, adding mm-hmm. backgrounds and some fancy color gradients.
With or without CSS back then?
With CSS already.
Already, okay. As I started, it was just HTML hacking. So it was like you actually, HTML was both the structure and this look and feel.
Yeah, it was just, I started a little bit with the HTML style. I think it was font style and font family, these kind of tags. But I found CSS more powerful, and
yeah, sure.
I could manage to make it work. Starting in Notepad++, so this was quite easy because I could just develop things, save the file, open the local file in my browser, and then just reload the page to see mm-hmm. the changes applied mm-hmm. immediately.
Exactly. I was a multimedia expert because what I knew is two special tags. One was Blink, and Blink mm-hmm. doesn't work anymore. But you know Marquee?
No, I don't. I know the name, but I haven't used it.
It still works. So it's like the font is moving over the screen with Marquee.
Ah, okay.
I tried Blink, it doesn't work anymore, but Marquee is working. So this is, if you would like, you know, to improve the Lambda Power Tools website experience, you could make, you know, whatever Power Tools moving back and forth. So, like, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Interestingly, I also started very early with HTML, but I also evaluated HTML editors and I really enjoyed that because there are lots of them. So I remember PageMill was a cool name. Then Adobe, there's one Adobe, a very, very famous one. So this is the obvious one. And Microsoft, this was always fun with Microsoft. How is it called? There was a Microsoft editor who generated really a strange HTML text who no one understood.
I remember something by Microsoft, but I forgot the name.
Yeah,
I
look it up.
Looking at the code, and yeah. I didn't like it because I couldn't understand anymore what was happening.
Then ColdFusion was also an editor. Forgot the editor. Hot Metal was also one. Hot Metal editor, and I have to remember the Microsoft one because it was epic. Everyone talk about the Microsoft because if you generate some HTML, no one could read it. I'm really curious whether it's still available for Microsoft. And Netscape had an own editor. The Netscape Navigator, they had an own HTML editor as well. So this is... And Notepad, of course. Notepad was the default. And later, Ultra Edit. Yeah.
Okay. I think I've never used actually Netscape Navigator. I use Internet Explorer, of course, where all the CSS tags weren't working mm-hmm. out of the box. But I've never used Netscape Navigator.
Front Page was the name of the Microsoft one.
Ah, okay.
And Adobe had even more famous one, but it was actually good. I think it's still around. Dreamweaver. Was the yeah. Adobe one, yeah.
And I know this one, yes.
And this one, the code was somehow okay. I mean, you could influence the source code more or less. Mm-hmm. So you could do your own website, I guess. Or yes. for your Minecraft club.
For my, a little bit for both of it. So it was like okay. my own little website. And then, hey, check out my Minecraft server.
And your Minecraft server was somehow special, like special world, or was just for your friends? So, you know, you had a mission with the Minecraft server, like you wanted to have a science fiction world or rebuild London or whatever, or was just fun with your friends?
It was just fun mostly. No, okay. no special vision. Everyone could do what they want, build what they want. It was no special server with any, you know, mm-hmm. it didn't have any plugins mm-hmm. like some servers had.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So then, what happened afterwards?
So what happened afterwards was just before university, mm-hmm. Starting some PHP to do some backend work okay. as well. Because my goal was to show on my website mm-hmm. if the Minecraft server is currently running and how many players are joined on the server. So I found some, the only reason why I use PHP was because I found a library that could connect to a Minecraft server if you give it the IP address and fetch some information of the server.
But this was like the admin interface, right, of the Minecraft server, I guess.
Yeah, I think it was like this, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I had to create a backend for this to save the state in a database. Mm-hmm. So the page loads quickly because the requests were quite slow.
Mm-hmm. And so you cached the data and the
refresh. Exactly. Yeah, I cached it. I had a little cron job running this PHP script and then saving it into relational MySQL database. Mm-hmm. And then the server serving my web page, it was just fetching the data from the MySQL database, and then I could display my first dynamic information on the website. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But interesting that you found PHP and nothing in Java, right? Because Java servlet could be with Java, Minecraft, maybe. Yeah, interesting. And it worked, I assume?
It worked, yes.
Was it hard for you to do this? Or so, okay, it's easy going?
I think the whole database stuff was a bit hard because I didn't fully understand how they are running on the server and how I can access the database after installing it. But after figuring out how to access it, it was pretty much following a lot of internet snippets, and PHP at the time had quite a lot of tutorials for databases.
The PHP and MySQL combo was very popular back then.
Yeah,
I remember I spent quite a lot of time explaining why we need transactions, because there are lots of websites which were quite successful with PHP and MySQL without using transactions. And clients,
you mean database transactions?
Yeah. Yeah, and they ask me, my clients ask me, why we have the entire circles with Java and transactions. If they are, they can go move faster just with PHP and without transactions. And then always explain, look, it only works, you know, if you don't recognize if the data is inconsistent. But if you have two actions, you would like to group them. So atomicity, right? So either everything happens or nothing. And so I spent all the time over and over again, you know, explaining why we need transactions back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't use any transactions.
Yeah, this was normal. This was normal. Yeah, yeah. For your case, it's not a problem at all. But what happened, there were lots of blogs back then about PHP on MySQL. They were read, they were popular. And they ask why PHP is so simple and Java so complicated. And the reasons being because it was just simple, because they didn't care about lots of stuff, which Java was famous for, no transactions. Back then, two-phase commits and stuff like that were normal, and PHP not available. It was complete different use cases back then, served by Java projects and by PHP.
Yeah, that's true. But I remember doing some transactions in PHP.
Cool.
And also reading about SQL injection attacks and sanitize user inputs for some queries against your database.
You already had a bad experience, yes? Okay.
Not really. I was just reading some blog posts where people said, hey, SQL is vulnerable if you have user inputs. And I was actually testing an SQL injection attack against my own website, you know, just by passing some, you know, something like a backtick and then select star from, and then I could essentially print my whole database. And then I found some library where you can use prepared statements to bind the user input to the SQL statement so they get properly sanitized. And it was cool to see that the same attack didn't work anymore afterwards. So probably unit tests before I even knew how unit tests work.
Okay. Yeah. Sometimes PHP developers joined my Java workshop, and they were always impressed about connection poolings, database connection poolings. They said, this is incredible, so simple. And it's okay for us, it's normal. We always had that, right? But it could impress PHP developers with connection poolings for unknown reasons. They really like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, now you're an enterprise PHP developer. On how did transition happen to something different than PHP?
Yeah, this was pretty much in university. So my first course at university, which was Software Engineering 1, was in Java, actually.
Okay.
Already
you hate Java. That, I think, right? So if you have the PHP experience and you saw Java, it's like, what is this about?
You would imagine I hate it, but I found Java like a really nice programming language right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, of course, things were harder to get started, you know, the getting the Hello World up and running, which is now mm-hmm. easier in Java 25. Mm-hmm. But in Java 8, which was my first Java version that I used, it was still a bit, I was wondering, why do I have to write public static void main just mm-hmm. to print Hello World? But besides that, this object-oriented way of coding in Java, when you do something and it really looks clean because all the types are mm-hmm. working perfectly, this was quite a good experience, and I really liked it from a developer point of view, because you had this safety that your application has a clear structure, type safety, of course, and I enjoyed it quite a lot from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. I also like the object-oriented principles, and what's what fascinated me, that you can somehow save time later, right? So you can write some superclasses, objects, or whatever, and then later you can inherit, and the work is done. So you can invest your time now and to save time later. Still fascinated by the idea, but not always with object orientation. But this is always, you know, the interesting question, how to save time in software engineering, because there are different strategies, you know, build framework or not, or write simple code and see what happens later. So and the object orientation is a little bit investing a little bit more time now and save it later if you do it correctly, right?
If you do it correctly, yeah. That's the good point. I remember quite a few times in my junior software engineering times, I added too many abstractions mm-hmm. in the beginning mm-hmm. and eventually never used them anymore.
Exactly.
So I invested time, but I never really needed the abstractions in the future.
This never happens by juniors. This is usually what happens by, you know, seasoned enterprise architects, because they say, okay, what if, and you have abstractions everywhere and no one needs them. So juniors are actually more pragmatic. They say, okay, why do we need this stuff you're thinking about? So
yeah.
But I also enjoy that. I've written in the beginning, I started with frameworks. Everything was abstracted. You can replace whatever, which is fun experience. So I still enjoy it in my leisure, but in commercial projects, a bit different, right? So
yeah, I had this kind of obsession where I didn't want to use a single dependency in my projects.
Well, we are very similar. The obsession happens to me right now. So
exactly. Yeah. which is probably a good strategy to reduce dependencies anyway, especially for lightweight Lambda workloads. But at the time, it was more of, I don't understand fully what's happening in a framework, so I don't want to use the framework. I want to implement it myself.
This was my thinking as well.
So I implemented this whole model view controller stuff myself. I implemented dependency injection myself using annotation
for what?
Processors.
For which project or why you did it?
Just some toy web applications. They didn't really have any purpose than learning how to build dependency injection or mm-hmm. building model view controller patterns. Mm-hmm. Because I read all over the internet about them on framework documents.
Which year was it roughly? When was it? 2010?
Probably, yeah, no. 2010, I was still in primary school.
Okay.
It was probably 2016, 2017.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, something around these times. So, of course, you already had a ton of frameworks that could solve this problem for you, but I really wanted to understand the inner workings of this. So I didn't want to use any frameworks at all.
Mm-hmm. Great mindset, I have to say. For me, it was the same, because my impression is everyone is smart and I don't understand it. And then I started to realize the others are just half understand something, pull the dependency, and then they look smart. And I say, okay, then it's a little bit dangerous, because who knows what's inside. and how to maintain the thing. Because at if you switch a lot of between projects, right? If you maintain multiple projects at the same time, you can remember all the features of all the dependencies. So this is And also, what I never liked is Java ships with lots of functionality. So before I use external dependency, I try to rely on something which is already available in Java. So this is, if you have the same mindset, I'm using the standard Mac terminal because it's already there. So I'm experimenting with different for fun. But if it already works, why should I use another one just to be different? So this is so. Interesting mindset. So you build your own frameworks which shipped with your applications to avoid external dependencies, but you learned a lot then, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I learned a lot from setting up web servers to building the applications that are served by the web servers without dependencies, which is probably why I ended up in the serverless space because of my tendency to make applications as lightweight as possible and only include what you really need.
Even my blog, I started my blog in 2006, and back then was a software called Roller Weblogger. And what I want to do is, I wanted to extend the software with a counter similar to yours. Right, so just a counter because I got lots of traffic, and I said, "Who actually, from where the traffic is coming from?" So I had to have just counters. So I guess that's easy because Roller Weblogger works with Hibernate, and I wanted to introduce JPA, Java Persistence API, and do this. And then I realized that internally is Spring use an old version, and I will have to upgrade the entire thing. And I said, "Okay, this sad." And then I created my own microservice externally with almost no dependencies, who did the job. And I even wrote back then a book about that, so as example for microservices. But, the Roller Weblogger become older and older with old dependencies. And I say, okay, now to upgrade this is a problem. So I re-implemented the entire block with Quarkus, but almost no external dependencies. So it's my own template engine. I did it actually during the pandemic time. It was like 1 week, but it was a cool week. And now I understand fully the code and can maintain it by myself. But if, let's say, Spring templates really come out with Java, I will replace my invention with standard Java. But this can be replicated because the standard Java will be available in all my other projects as well. So it's getting even better because now I have the deep knowledge how Java works and can apply the knowledge everywhere. But if I would use an external library template, I could apply it once and hope that my clients are using similar stack, which is almost impossible, So that's also good if you focus on standards, because then you don't have to learn that much. You can be more lazier, actually, and have more vacations. So it's also, pretty cool.
How did you format your HTML templates with your custom build solution?
I will cut it out, but I can tell you right now. So it is very simple. It's just basically string replace all with custom tags right now. So it is slow. It is slow, but for me it's okay. I don't need for loop nothing. It's just I exactly know how pose look like. I know the slots, so this works. But it was a hack because a new string templates will come out with Java, and they didn't. So I'm running on prototype right now, but I could replace it with free marker whatever immediately if I like. But I don't like. So if it works. It works perfectly, and it was unit testable, very simple. Also, Quarkus ships with Qt templates. I could use them. They are faster, but my thing is very fast. So, I mean, it should be slow because replace all is slow, but it's fast. So,
okay,
fast enough for me. But it's nothing for Netflix, So this is, it will burn way too much CPU.
Yeah.
And CSS, of course. So it's externalized, and But it works on Docker on my own server. So, but it could be Lambda as well. No problem. So you did actual job with Java after your experiments with block, but actually it's a cool story. So you experimented a lot in your leisure, right? Just for fun.
Yeah. Just for fun. Probably. Yeah. 7 days a week, every day I was experimenting with several programming tasks. And one of the reasons why I got into a side job at university, where I joined a student consultancy, where we were working on projects with real clients. And so I was, of course, always hired for all the tech projects because I did all the programming work in my free time. I learned quite a lot in software engineering, and this was kind of my first professional experience working as a freelance software engineer during my university time already on consulting projects.
It's exactly in my case, identical. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, I also started as a freelancer during my university and worked as consultant, and also trainer for Sun Microsystems back then as a freelancer. So lots of parallels, and also really enjoyed the time, but it was hard because what happened to me is I recognized that what I learned at the university is not necessarily what I need later, you know? So it was harder and harder for me to keep motivated to be a good student if I knew exactly what the professor says is not always true. I remember there was some, you know, dispute with the profs about how databases are working, and what they said, okay, what they told me is, okay. It could work, but it didn't in practice. What kind of software you became? So what your gigs were during your university work?
Yes, so I had, I think the two largest projects I worked on were in the aerospace industry. So one project was, and it's still working in production today, actually, is an e-learning platform. So for example, when you are a company who needs certain certifications like mm-hmm. ISO 9001 for quality mm-hmm. management, or certain other certifications, you need to train your workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And I built this software for an auditing company focusing in the aerospace industry. And mm-hmm. this software is used for customers of this auditing company to essentially operationalize certain processes that are related to e-learning trainings mm-hmm. At customers of this company. So it was pretty much a software as a service product that was resold by this customer of mine.
Perfect. And but it was not your stack, right? You used Spring or Java or something different, right?
So this, funny enough, this was I built this from scratch, this application, together with three other people over the course of probably 4 years.
But it's not even servlets. Servlets you used, right? Servlets.
It's not even in Java, actually.
Ah, what so is it?
This one is in PHP using Symfony frameworks. Because when I started it, I knew PHP still better than Java. Only my second project, this one.
But then I'll be impressed. If you started a plain Java project, you know, with Java SE, and you had to implement servlet first, and everything, then we said, that's cool, actually, right? This is,
Yeah, so this was in PHP. Which was working quite well.
It will still work well. I mean, Facebook was built on PHP, and it also is working, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. And I say the Symfony framework in PHP is probably the Spring framework equivalent in the mm-hmm. PHP world. Mm-hmm. So it had quite a lot of enterprise-ready features already built in, mm-hmm. proper dependency management. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this was how I started building my first software for which I earned money.
Perfect. And what was your first Java project?
My first Java project was a university project. It had nothing to do with web development, but rather focused on electricity trading. So at my university, there is an institute that focuses on energy research, and one of the tools they have is a simulation platform that simulates electricity markets in the future, assuming that there are, for example, only renewable energies available.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the challenges you have in such a market is peak demands by customers if you're an electricity provider, because renewable energies cannot produce electricity mm-hmm. on demand anymore. So this was a whole simulation, and you had different agents who could act in this within this simulation software, and each agent was developed by a research group. I was the member of one of these research groups, and everything was written in Java using the Spring framework. Not Spring Boot, but different modules of the Spring framework.
The XML edition.
Yes, exactly. So I built one of these trading agents all in Java. And this was my first, I'd say, large Java project.
And you enjoyed that?
Yeah, I really enjoyed that because it was my first, you know, you would, when you hear machine learning, you think about Python. But it turns out you can actually implement relatively simple time series forecasting in plain Java without external dependencies. And it runs very fast, a lot faster than in Python, depending on which library you use.
Yeah. And even more interesting, I think it was JDK 1.1. This was 97, 98. Java had so-called Egglet framework, and an Egglet was an agent.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I never heard of this.
Yeah, Egglets. You have to look it up. And I think it was also initiated by IBM. And the agents were not just agents as we know them today, the ship and agent and the response. The idea of the agent is it was a moving Java code. So the agent could move from machine to machine. So there was an own class loader. You could implement the agent, and the agent moved to another machine. You know, then there was different environment, could ask for APIs. And then in order to complete the task, moved somewhere else. So like this was back then, lots of research. So there was, if you're interested in it, it was Egglets. Similar framework was Genie, Java Intelligent Network Infrastructure. But this was where the agent would usually ask the API to do something. Yeah, this was a fun time. So right now, we are, after 20 years, we arrived. Yeah.
Yes.
This is actually... also interesting, one of my commercial projects was very similar to yours. I don't know whether it was trading, but it was like, you know, serving the electricity market. And what we also implemented in Pure Java, so I was just a consultant, but like the visualization of all the wires everything was in Java back then. Oh, it was not Java as I came in. We migrate with a small team, and the team was highly passionate, I think within 1 year, to Java, and they really enjoyed the experience. And after that, we overtook the competitors. This was the interesting part. And sad story, they were so successful that the management tried to hire more and more developers to move even faster, and then they were no more successful because, you know, their spirit was lost. And almost identical to your project, what you described. Maybe it was based, yeah. It was in the near Frankfurt. So this was
okay. What I can tell you. Yeah, mine was in Cologne.
Okay, could be similar. Okay, this is cool. And then after university, you stick with Java?
After university, I didn't stick with Java at first. So my first job out of university was actually working at AWS, where I'm working today.
Uh-huh. How this happened?
So this happened, I did an internship at AWS in Dublin during COVID.
And Dublin is hardcore. So Dublin is like, there's lots of engineers. They implement deep technology there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I was... So this internship I did was in the Frontier Networking team, which is building some of the hybrid cloud offerings that AWS has, for example, AWS Outposts or Ground Station, these kind of services. And I was within a networking research and development group, so working in a service team as a software development engineer on these networking technologies. And in the networking, you know, control plane space, Python was more dominant at the time. So I worked quite a lot in Python and also a little bit of Rust. So just because these languages were used. So I learned a lot of Python, which I had already learned in a lot of statistical analysis and machine learning courses at university. So Python felt quite natural to me after finishing university. I also joined the same team to work there as a software engineer.
I have a natural resistance to Python, I have to admit. I have I bought several books, and I think the oldest is like 20 years old. And I always wanted to start. I look at the code like later. Now it's something else to do. So this was my. But one time I will learn Python. So yeah, I promise. But I don't know why Ruby. I actually wanted to learn Ruby because the aesthetics around Ruby. Also, I like Ruby more than Python. But also had no time for Ruby back then. This was a crazy Java time. But I would like to learn Python, but I have zero motivation, which is a bad. But yeah, right now crazy times. But one point of time, I will learn Python.
Yeah, I can recommend Python. I learned to enjoy it.
You learned to enjoy it. So what was your initial reaction to Python?
You know, when you have really large systems and no statically typed language, things can become messy sometimes. Yeah. So you rely on static code analysis for type checking. Mm-hmm. So for example, in Python, you can use MyPy to check type hints. Mm-hmm. But sometimes MyPy doesn't fully understand everything that you do because it's static code analysis in a non-type safe language. And so when I had to write code just to satisfy the code linting tools, this was something I didn't like a lot. But these were really rare occasions, and most of the time, it almost felt like working in a statically typed language, with sometimes even less boilerplate code than what's needed for certain things in Java. So that's how I learned to love it over time. But in the beginning, of course, the whole code linting tools, which were sometimes also slow for large code bases, I really had to get used to.
Okay. And then you were hired by Amazon after that, or AWS?
Yes, I was hired by AWS after that.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah, straight from Cologne, I moved to Dublin to start my first job at AWS.
Regarding Outpost, and good you mentioned Outpost, because I always forget the name, because I always remember immediately the snow. How it's called? The snow truck, of course, is the most famous one, but the entire family, the snow, how's it called the family snow?
Snow devices?
Yeah, exactly. What's the name of a device? Snow.
I think there are several devices.
Yeah. But I remember the snow devices, but never Outpost. And this is why I talk about that, to remember it better the next time. But recently, I actually compared the prices of Outpost to an on-premise solution, and they were actually competitive. So I have to say, you know, I thought that was Mission Impossible, it's way too expensive. But the largest Outpost was significantly cheaper than actually the offer, which has nothing to do with the cloud. It was just on-premise rack, and you can run amazing stuff on the Outpost, and it becomes like your own region, right? So you can. Yep. This was a hands-on experience with Outposts, and now I hopefully will never forget the term Outpost again. One was snow cone. There is one snow cone or snow ball. They are different, right?
Snow ball is definitely one of them.
The small one and the mid range is interesting, which does performs the backup. But I forgot the name, so
I think the names were. I think it was renamed recently, so I don't know. Which are the current names?
Okay, and which. Is there like a department or for which you work, or is just AWS? So if you work for AWS, AWS, or is it in the AWS serverless, AWS EC2, or how to call it? So
you mean in the Outpost space?
No, in you are hired by AWS. What AWS?
So I was hired by AWS. It's just a development center in Dublin. Mm-hmm. But my organization was in the network core.
Network Core, okay.
Was my organization.
Yes. Wow. But this is like really low level.
Yeah, it was really low level. I was also on call, was paged several times during night, of course.
So you're a hardcore developer, you know?
Hardcore developer.
It's not like serverless, you know, stitching things together. So you did actually the foundation of the cloud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like, you know, even when I was not in university yet, I started to try mm-hmm. to understand the foundations. And this was really great way to continue doing that in like a low level mm-hmm. network development mm-hmm. space.
Mm-hmm. And what happened then? Because you are no more there, I guess. So
No more. So earlier this year, I relocated from Dublin to Zurich in Switzerland.
Ah, how do you like Dublin, by the way, if you are relocated? It was a nice experience from city and living? Or
yeah, it was a really great experience. I'd mm-hmm. say you have lots of social activities, mm-hmm. Very friendly people.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a city with a lot of atmosphere. It was mm-hmm. really great living there. It was a lot of fun.
I was invited their Java user group, but not in Dublin. I think it was Dublin or another city. Also, but I spent time in Dublin and 2 days and really enjoyed the experience as well.
Yeah, and you have the coast is just next to Dublin. So, for mm-hmm. instance, from my place, I could just walk to the beach and then be at the sea.
Yeah, perfect. This is harder in Zurich, I would say.
That's harder in Zurich, although you have a big lake.
Yeah, the Zurich Sea is perfect. Uh-huh. Zurich Lake.
Yeah.
Okay, so you moved to Zurich just because you wanted to relocate, right? This was the...
It was partly because I wanted to relocate, but also because my partner found a job in Zurich, and so uh-huh. we moved to the same city.
Mm-hmm.
And then a great new opportunity came up in the Power Tools for AWS Lambda team, which is how I got the job that I'm working in today.
Uh-huh. So you applied or you got asked whether you can work with the Lambda team? Or
So I applied internally. And funny enough, before I even knew that the Power Tools for AWS Lambda team is hiring, probably half a year before that, when I was still working in Dublin, I submitted a pull request to the Python GitHub repository because I needed a certain feature.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the maintainers asked me, hey, why don't you want to work on this feature? And so I just went ahead and implemented it. And so when I saw in the internal transfers tool, Power Tools for AWS Lambda is hiring,
mm-hmm.
I thought that's a great chance for me to still do a lot of engineering work as a library author, you know, and at the same time also be in the city that I wanted to move to.
Perfect. And now you have a Java code. So was it a shock after your Python experience back in Java, or you enjoy it, or what's the experience now?
I think at first it was, I wouldn't say it was a shock, but it felt like, it's good to be back.
Oh, really? That's Java. Good news. Otherwise, I would cut it out, but okay.
No, it really felt like that because after learning all the Java formally at university and then using it for a lot of, you know, research projects, but never a lot for enterprise projects. Mm-hmm. It was great to finally do some Java again in my full-time work position.
Mm-hmm.
And I even mentioned this to some of my colleagues before, while I was still working in the team in Dublin. I was always the guy who did Java. Whenever there was a chance to do Java for API clients or something, I was the Java guy in the team. Mm-hmm. And now I can work Java pretty much full time as a library developer, which is great.
And this is visible because I went to GitHub and I was curious whether you are just a manager, right, or a coder. And since you're there, there's a spike in the GitHub activity on AWS Lambda tools, and you're catching up. So it's like, yeah, you do a lot of work, which is, of course, great. So maybe we should explain first what Lambda is, right? So what Lambda is like, my explanation would be, is from Java perspective. So just for Java developers, forget, because this is, we've just focused on Java. You deploy Java, and there is like a function handler, which is a method. You specify the method, you tell the Lambda runtime, call my method, and if event happens, the method is called, the Java class is instantiated for you, so the constructor is called, method is called, And then the Lambda remains warm for a couple of minutes or not, but usually it does. And then you pay for the call, and millions of calls are 1 million is usually free, or you have to go to AWS calculator. But my calculation is always two such calls per second, and 100 millisecond response time is roughly between, let's say, $15 and $20 or $10 and $20, it depends on memory and so forth. And that's Lambda. But you are working on like extensions of Lambda. This is the Lambda Power Tools, right?
Yes, it's Power Tools for AWS Lambda. Mm-hmm. That's the library name. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on this project, which is a serverless development toolkit that helps to increase developer velocity, because you have a lot of patterns on Lambda that mm-hmm. are repeatable and can be encapsulated in individual lightweight utilities. And this is an open source library on GitHub that's mm-hmm. available in different languages. I'm the Java tech lead in the team, so I'm the open source maintainer for the Java version of this project. But we also have it available in TypeScript, Python, and mm-hmm. .NET or C Sharp. Mm-hmm. So we have utilities ranging from observability solutions. Mm-hmm. So for example, structured JSON logging mm-hmm. Is one of the utilities where you can have Lambda-specific information like the function ID, X-ray trace ID automatically injected mm-hmm. in your logs. Metrics and tracing are other utilities, and these kind of observability utilities we call our core utilities mm-hmm. because they make up the core of like a production ready mm-hmm. application, because mm-hmm. Especially in serverless scenarios, it's due to the distributed way of working, you have different Lambda handlers that might interact with each other. You mentioned event-driven events already, and in event-driven architectures, of course, it's important to be able to trace requests across the different components involved. Mm-hmm. And this is easily doable with these observability solutions.
This is a deeper topic, but one thing is what you can do is you can help us even to be more scalable, or even to save costs, because what you can also do is you are caching requests, right? This is the parameters, for instance. So you could say, I don't need to fetch the same parameter every time. I can cache it a little bit, and then every 10 times it gets refreshed behind the scenes. You could implement this by yourself, but this is already tested and ready to use. So this is the basic idea. So like this boilerplate is already put it somewhere, and it is based on best practices, because you are from AWS. You can also ask the service teams, you know, hey, what's about that? It's this good idea. So we get, you know, a bundled best practices knowledge from AWS for AWS products, which is a good thing. This is,
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, a lot of these utilities map directly to recommendations from the mm-hmm. well-architected framework, from mm-hmm. the serverless lens mm-hmm. of this mm-hmm. framework, which is mm-hmm. a collection of best practices and patterns that you can apply for these kind of workloads.
What we have to do is I will re-invite you back and to talk specifically about the Lambda Power Tools, because it's a deeper topic, and the listeners are not necessarily, you know, AWS gurus. And for some topics, you know, we have to explain that there is parameter store and secrets, and we have logging, yeah. CloudWatch, and there's no black magic terms if you don't know AWS. But if you don't know AWS, if you do know AWS, it is just product names. It's not a problem. What I don't like about the Lambda Power Tools is the AspectJ dependency. So I look at this several times. So what I do is I tag the Power Tools as a inspiration and mm-hmm. Try, you know, to avoid the AspectJ. And the question is, could it be avoided in future? You know, do you think it will be possible to further reduce the dependency on external libraries with AWS Lambda Tools?
Can I ask, before answering, can I ask why you don't like the AspectJ dependency?
It was widely overused in all enterprise projects. This is and there were basically no use cases except these use cases which remained for power tools, for Lambda, right? Mm-hmm. And I know, but by the way, very good question. So this is engineering questions. I don't care why, right? So this is always why. Micronaut does... Micronaut and Quarkus, they have similar problems. So what Micronaut does is Micronaut tries to or has to, they want to avoid reflection to be fast at startup time. And what they do is they read Java annotations and are generating bytecode in advance and they use the compiler for it. And Quarkus uses own extension mechanism with the same principle. So it uses, so the outcome is almost the same, but there are competing frameworks actually, but the mechanisms are different, but similar. So you have metadata in annotations and one uses compiler and the other one own extensions to do that. And Aspect J, you're right. You could see this as a standard almost because it's AOP, but I would be happier if this would be a built-in Java technology, compiler extension, whatever, right? So whatever Java provides, and maybe there is somewhere. So I'm not prepared in this, but because Java standardized the ASM more or less, it becomes part of the Java ecosystem. It's a different level, but maybe you know the question: what do you need? You have to react maybe to annotations and generate bytecode, whether there is maybe a simple Java mechanism so we can get rid of third-party library. This is just my thinking.
Yeah. I think it's a good thinking. And the main value proposition for AspectJ and Power Tools from a library authoring perspective was that it allows us to compile time weave logic mm-hmm. into the code mm-hmm. in a way that's still understandable for external contributors to the project as well. Because we also need to think about how easily are people from the community able to contribute mm-hmm. code to Power Tools for AWS Lambda as mm-hmm. well. And AspectJ as an industry standard was a good way. And the compile time weaving of logic into bytecode is also a good way to avoid increasing Lambda startup times a lot mm-hmm. by, for example, exactly. reading annotations reflectively. But for instance, for newer utilities, like for example, the Kafka consumer mm-hmm. utility that we have, we don't rely on AspectJ.
Oh, very good.
So potentially we will be able to reduce AspectJ dependencies mm-hmm. in the future, although there's no plan for some of the utilities to do it. But one thing that I want to mention is that you don't have to use AspectJ for most of the utilities.
Yes.
You only have to use it if you want to use the nice and easy annotation-based way of, mm-hmm. of interacting with Power Tools. But you can use a programmatic interface in like the imperative programming style as well for most utilities. Mm-hmm. It's just that certain actions don't happen automatically anymore that are wrapped within this annotation.
This is what I used. So back then I used, I take a look at Power Tools and I always thought, okay, I can get rid of the AspectJ, which was true, but I had always bad feeling it's really meant that way. But yeah, it worked. But I have to tell you, this AspectJ lost a little bit popularity. I think if mm-hmm. you would ask, you know, at Java conferences, who knows AspectJ or who works with AspectJ, I would say it would be like 10% of the audience or maybe 5%. You know?
Okay.
It's not like the leading frame, but this is just my impression. But because I didn't saw this in project for years, AspectJ.
Yeah.
And if I would use it, I will ask you the same question you ask, why are you using this? Because I think this... I never use Spring, but Spring has own mechanism of aspects. And what I know for sure, Micronaut and Quarkus and all the others, we have interceptors, and it's nothing. It works like AspectJ without external dependency, for instance. So mm-hmm. This is why AspectJ is unusual in enterprise space, I would say.
Yeah, I should definitely look into this Micronaut mm-hmm. way, how they do it. Because I was searching for alternatives.
Yeah, look at Micronaut. I think you will like it. And also yeah. look at Quarkus. It is proprietary Quarkus way, but they had to solve a lot of problems. But what Quarkus and Micronaut also doing, they're providing that way information for GraalVM compilation, right? So if just take a look at the approach, maybe you get a good inspiration what could work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say this is the cliffhanger for the next episode, and maybe we walk through the best practices first, and if you have time, we can talk about, you know, the AWS Lambda Power Tools, because it's still, from my perspective, an underused, utility. It's not a framework. How do you call it? It's not a framework. How do you call it? Library.
I'd say it's a toolkit, like a toolkit, set of utilities, exactly. Toolkit. Because mm-hmm. all modules are independent mm-hmm. of each other, yes.
And one question is how your last name is officially pronounced in German or whatever, like, is this how you pronounce it?
It's pronounced Page.
Uh-huh.
But usually when I speak English, I say Page.
This is what I think, I guess Page, it can be, you know, Page. And I was just curious. And you said Dublin, so okay, then Page. And now I was back to Zurich, okay, then Page. Perfect. And Lambda Power Tools, is there an official website?
Yes, so we have an official website and recently also moved our documentation to the official AWS documentation.
This domain. Is what I have here. Open is docs.aws.amazon.com. PowerTools/Java latest.
So the website is powertools.aws.dev.
Ah, okay.
You can see some customer mm-hmm. references as well.
Perfect. Yeah, you really surprised me by, you know, your core network passed from core network to serverless. This is actually a contrast.
Yeah,
actually, this is the absolute contrast, you know. Low-level networking and serverless, these are two opposites. You cannot be farther away.
Yeah, right. It's true. But the low-level networking, believe it or not, we had Lambda functions running for
everywhere.
Orchestrating
so, yeah,
certain
yeah.
things. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Is it network config deployment changes and then do some little mm-hmm. interception for an event, take a Lambda function to do it and... Mm-hmm. It's a great way of doing it.
Yeah. And my understanding is the Lambdas is like the, how it's called, the base zero or the essential service for AWS, right? There's lots of stuff happens behind the scenes using Lambda. It's one of the core technologies.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you develop things internally and you don't have any restrictions, you usually try to use the service that has the highest level of abstraction, mm-hmm. which is Lambda and then ECS Fargate. Mm-hmm. And only if for some reason you can't use any of those or you need lower level control of which mm-hmm. specific Linux version has to run or something, mm-hmm. You can even use ECS on EC2 instances mm-hmm. Or plain EC2 instances.
I'm with you, but I'm even more radical. So what I sometimes did for no code, so no, you don't have to use Lambda. Yeah. If you can, for instance, use just step function in DynamoDB without Lambda, you can directly wire the APIs. And of course, I use Java for CDK. So we have Java, which configures the cloud. But at runtime, there is nothing. Or what you can do is you can even, you know, glue together the API gateway with DynamoDB directly without Lambda. So this is also interesting because then you don't have no dependencies at all. And for some use cases is just great because why you should develop something and think about that if can be completely provided by the cloud. And by the way, interestingly, we have a similar mindset, but for different reasons. So as a consultant, you know, some of my clients are on premises, on private cloud, or how to call it. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion is if you already are on premise, then just use the features of on premise.
Yeah.
You know, not abstract the on-premise capability. So you can use, I don't know what they are aware of, or sure, a Java Mission Control, Flight Recorder, just go crazy and do the best Java experience you can get because it can do a lot more than on Lambda, of course. But if you go to the cloud, why you're replicated, you know, replicating your on-premise experience with the cloud, then yeah. I will pick all the features available on AWS to really use them to have the advantage. Otherwise, yeah. it doesn't make any sense, you know, to have mediocre architecture, which works good or somehow okay on-premise and somehow okay on the cloud. And then I say, okay, this is like why we are doing this, right? Everything has to be a reason. So this is why I'm absolutely with you. My standard architecture, if we have some persistent, is Lambda and S3. And if this doesn't work, why not? Okay, then maybe DynamoDB. If not DynamoDB, whatever. But this is like, you know, we start with the simplest possible thing and say, if not, why not? So this is why I like a question, why are you not happy with AspectJ? This is always why. Why? This is the best question you can ask.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it became also my default mm-hmm. stack working with Lambda as default.
And this is also good to explain the architecture. No? If someone asks me why you did it, that's the explanation. And if it doesn't work, we can pick this. And of course, costs are also important, right? Because but this is always clear in the cloud. There's AWS calculator or calculator.aws. This is other way around. So this is how we start the project. So if you have no 1,000 of requests per second, you know that Lambda becomes more expensive. Then what I will do is, okay, then maybe take a look at EC2, you know, how much EC2 machines we need and how much we can save and how much we will have to invest to build this solution. Because if EC2 machines, you have to rotate them, you need a load balancer, you need, you know, blue-green deployment, and Lambda does everything out of the box. So you don't... Yeah. This is...
I also think one thing that you should use in if you use serverless architectures is the whole event emission system that comes from the AWS services itself, and then using filtering to filter out when your Lambda function should run or not, in Event Bridge, for example.
Maybe we do the next topic just about
money. Yeah,
just about event-driven architectures, because this also, I hate the term, and the reason being is, in Java projects, everyone wanted to be before cloud, event driven, but there were no events. So what they did, right? So they say, okay, I have a microservice, and we emit the event, and then the event is consumed, you know, one method later. And then I ask, why you just don't call the method? Why we need the entire circus with the events?
If it's running on the same server,
lots of events. No one knew what's going on. There was and then it artificially introduced microservices to be distributed. And in one project, they use Arc, I remember still. And they asked me, what actually is happening behind the scenes? We don't understand at all. It's like, I have no idea. So let's take a look. But on AWS cloud, what happens is everything emits events. So we only have to listen. There's nothing to do, you know. I can take a look on S3 where the event is stored. Is my build successful? Yes or no. Everything is distributed via Event Bridge or CloudWatch Event was the old name, but you know, everything already happened. So we only have to listen, which makes absolute sense. So okay. This is topics for the next episode. And have a great time and great day. It was nice to talk with you. And see you next time.
Thank you. You too.
Where can people maybe find you on social media, if you like? You are LinkedIn, Twitter?
My LinkedIn is Philip Page.
Philip Page. Mm-hmm.
Twitter, I'm not really active. So probably it's just LinkedIn.
LinkedIn.
That's my most active platform.
Thank you a lot.
Thanks, Adam.